I had to volunteer at a casino yesterday. Have you ever done that?
The worst, yeah.
You have?
Yeah, I used to do it a lot. I was probably way worse when I did it, to be fair. Because I did it in like the 90s. Yeah, than now. But I imagine it's still not fun.
How could it be worse in the 90s? Like, it's not, it's volunteer work. They didn't, did you get like a free meal and...
I think we did get a free meal actually, but it was just that like, and I don't know what it's like. I don't know what it's like in a bingo hall now. I haven't been in one in a long time, but in the 90s, it was a place where people went to play bingo, I guess.
Okay.
Right. As much as like.
You're talking specifically about a bingo hall, not a casino. Is that right?
That's right. A bingo hall. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Oh, sorry. You worked a casino?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. But, sorry, I misunderstood.
It's probably the same kind of experience. Go. I want to hear more about the bingo hall.
Yeah, well, the bingo hall was a place where people went to play bingo. As much as you can play bingo when there's like a thousand other people playing it around you. Like, I don't know. It's weird. You're just like marking things on a sheet. You're not really playing anything unless like you're the one person that happens to like make a line or something.
Right. But you're enjoying a pack of cigarettes and gabbing with your friends, right?
This is exactly right.
Yeah.
It's a place where people go to smoke and talk to their friends.
Yeah.
So, and in the 90s, there was no way to clear that smoke out of the building. So, no. Like, I would wake up the next day with, like, a hangover and having not drunk a drop of alcohol. Yes. Like, just the smoke. There was so much smoke in the building. It was just like, yeah, it was like working as a firefighter without the danger.
Shale, that was like, I don't know if you remember, but that's what every single bar and nightclub and pub was like before 2006.
Yeah, but the bingo hall was worse, honestly. Like, I mean, I know you're right, but the bingo hall was way worse. Like, it was just so full of smoke. It was crazy. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it only felt worse because the lights were on, but I'm pretty sure it was like,
right,
I don't know, twice the amount of smoke or something.
That's something, it's... This is dumb, but it's so easy to forget that, like, going to a bar or to a nightclub, it meant even if you don't smoke at all, the next day your throat would be sore because there was so much smoke in the room and your clothes would reek. It was almost impossible to wash the smell of smoke out of your clothes. But that was like, that was people who went to bars every weekend. Like that happened every single weekend. Like, it was, you probably were taking years off your life just being in those rooms for a few hours, but.
Yeah. Well, and I smoked cigarettes socially when I was like the age that I was going to bars. And I think maybe a little bit at the age when I was doing bingos, like a little bit like later on when I was like working bingos, I was working them to raise funds for our ski team.
Right.
And yeah.
So. Yeah, you might as well smoke a cigarette if you're in that room because, like, there's no difference.
Well, yeah, you're like smoking like 30 while you're there. It's like smoking a pack and a half or something. It's crazy.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'll say this even though obviously you already know this. I wasn't really aware of this until I had kids, but at casinos in Alberta, and I assume across North America, but certainly in Alberta, a portion of revenues is given charitably to, groups that help the social good. So things like daycares and after school care programs, preschools, community leagues, probably a dozen other types of operations that I can't think of right now.
Right. When you use the word charitably, you're using the logistical sense of the word, right?
Not the figurative. Like the casino calls it charity nights or charity drives, but they are required by law to do them. So I'm not saying that they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart. And so the trade-off is that the organization has to provide volunteers for, it's usually over 2 days, like over a weekend. It's not always over a weekend, but they usually are contributing volunteers to help with, for instance, cashier positions, like actually counting out the money when people are bringing in chips or running chips to tables or at the end of the night counting the money boxes that are taken off the tables and blah, blah, blah. And so I've been between childcare and my involvement in the community league, I've done, I've volunteered at, I think, 4 different casino nights at Edmonton. And okay. It's kind of insane, especially because I don't spend a lot of time in casinos. And I, besides these volunteer stints, I really have only been to a casino a few times in my life. Mm-hmm. And so being exposed to that culture is always a little bit shocking, to be honest. But also, many of these shifts happen in the middle of the night. So the one that I worked this past weekend started at 11 p.m. on Saturday and ended at 3:30 a.m. on Sunday morning.
Oh, my God.
And it's...
I feel like you're not maybe necessarily that much of a night owl, Alan.
Well, I mean, I do... I'm almost never up until 3 a.m. That hasn't happened in years and years. But I mean, I do, because I work evenings, I don't usually go to bed till midnight. But anyways, it's crazy. Being exposed to the culture is crazy. If you're volunteering in the count room, it's like we counted $500,000 in cash that night.
It's like Goodfellas.
So that, yeah, well, I always think of Scarface because they have the money counting machines.
Right.
But anyways, the other really crazy thing about it is that for some of these positions, depending on the night, you might be there for 6 hours, but you're really only doing 20 minutes of work. There's almost always a huge amount of downtime between, like, say, if you're a chip runner, it's like a few times over a 6 hour shift, you are called to run chips to a table. So all that to say, the real benefit of my volunteer shift at Pure Casino on Saturday and Sunday was I had downtime to start reading the Noma in Kyoto journal, which
nice.
I got in the mail last week. And I wanted, maybe someday we'll do a full kind of take on it, but there was
book
one
report.
Particular, yeah, exactly. And I do have the extra copy that we need to figure out how we're going to give away to a
Great.
Listener. But there was one particular point that I wanted to bring up with you. And I think it's in the opening piece by Red Zeppi, where he, again, specifically says that Kyoto Kaiseki culture and service influenced the French Nouvelle Cuisine in the 1960s. And you've speculated that in conversations on kind of global cross-pollination in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly... René Red Zeppi would know better than me, but it was interesting to me that he again did not provide any evidence of it.
Right.
If he says that Kaiseki culture influenced this like post 2000 new wave of high end restaurants, like post El Bulli restaurants, I believe him, because like if he says that it influenced Noma's style of service, then I'll believe him.
Know. Yeah.
And he mentions specific books that he read on Kaiseki and visiting interning at Kaiseki restaurants in Kyoto. So if he says that influenced Noma, obviously I believe him. But mm-hmm. then to say that it influenced the French Nouvelle cuisine, I just need the evidence, because we don't, unless I am missing something, like we don't have mm-hmm. evidence that Fernand Point or Alain Ducasse or whatever, like worked in Japan. And they certainly wouldn't have had the same access to information that we do now. And so mm-hmm. I'm not saying that anyone's lying, Shale. I'm so curious to know what the concrete connection or evidence is. Cause none of those chefs, well, maybe they do, but like at the very least, those chefs were usually very candid with what their inspirations were. And so I mm-hmm. want to see the quote. I want to see the, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do know what you mean. And I mean, like, even in the article that I cited on the podcast,
mm-hmm.
it was, I don't know, what's the best way of putting it?
Shoot, I forgot that you had cited a specific article. I don't even remember what it was.
Oh, okay. I believe I put it in the show notes, but I don't remember what episode that was. And so I should go back and figure out what that article was exactly. But yeah, in the article that I cited, the connections, I believe, were still somewhat speculative. Like mm-hmm. there is evidence of French chefs going to Japan during that time period. There is evidence of a cross-pollination of ideas, but, you know, as far as the heavy hitters go, like Ducasse, like
mm-hmm.
that, you know, that is, you know, I think somewhat more tenuous in terms of the connection. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe there's a book to be written there, Alan. Do you want to?
Sure.
You want to pull Bill Buford and like.
Sure.
Talking
yeah.
to a Japanese chef and then try and insert yourself into the kaiseki culture so that you can start to try and tease out tenuous connections between.
Oh man. Yeah. I'll quit my job so that I can start writing the grant to fund that.
Yeah, exactly. It's a passion project.
Well, anyways, if anyone out there has any information, like Renee, if you have information.
Yeah, exactly. Renee, since you're obviously listening, just tell us about exactly how that all happened.
Just DM.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my good friend, Alan Sutterby. I'm going to try that again. It sounded like I was hesitant.
Sounded like you knew you were lying. It was like you almost choked on your words.
It's because I didn't have anything planned to say, but it's exactly what it sounded like. It was like, my friend.
Okay. That has to stay in.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my good friend, Alan Sutterby. How you doing, Alan?
Great. Thanks for asking.
We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. So, Alan, mm-hmm. I love asking this question when I already know the answer. Do you have any follow-up?
Oh, we do. We've got some real juicy follow-up, Shale.
Juicy follow-up.
There's a little bit of... it's born out of some of the, there's a little bit of chatter on the social media this week. Because after our last recording, Noodle Feast, I had just put up some pictures of the actual products that we tasted, pictures that you had taken, but just of the packaging and the brands that we were tasting.
Yeah, thanks for posting that.
And one of our followers, his name's Larry Harris. He's a baker here in Edmonton and has a blog and actually a little operation called Bon Vie Bakery, which I've actually mentioned on the show before, really wonderful sourdough bread. He commented on these photos that he's interested to check some of these brands out now that he will never be eating Momofuku noodles again. and so I asked him.
Alan, I feel like an influencer. Is that... but I should be getting brand PR like all the TikTokers.
We'll get free instant noodles rep them. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I asked Larry if he had beef with Chang or if he just didn't like the Momofuku noodles. And mm-hmm. so he put me onto this article that I had missed. It's from The Guardian on April 4th, and it's about, I think, so the actual title of the article is Trademark Bully, in quotation marks, Momofuku mm-hmm. turns up heat on others selling chili crunch. And so basically, Momofuku Goods, the company that makes products that we've talked about on the show, like Momofuku noodles and Momofuku chili crunch, has sent out a series of cease and desist letters to food companies in the United States that are using the terms chili crunch and chile crunch on their packaging, telling them that they have 90 days to stop doing this. And sorry.
That's interesting because I thought it was I thought the name of the Momofuku product was Chili Crisp, but I guess that's just.
No,
like
it's Crunch. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah,
and so one thing that I just need to clarify before we go any further, I'm just going to, instead of annoyingly spelling out words for the next few minutes, there's two spellings that they're going after. So chili spelled C-H-I-L-I, I'm going to say as chili. And if I say Chile, like the country, like I'm talking about the word spelled C-H-I-L-E.
Okay.
And so...
I believe that's pronounced chile.
Well, actually, Shale, it is the... So chili ending in an I is the common American English term for the peppers and the preparation, the Spanish language term. And so the prevalent term in Mexico for those peppers would be chile ending in an E. Canada okay. kind of, like in a lot of these things, waffles between the two. But I think technically in Canada, like most style guides and publication would tell you to spell it with an I. So like the yeah. American English way. Anyways, okay, so the piece is, it talks to some of the people who operate companies who have received these letters. So notably, there's a woman named Michelle Tu, who has a company called Homia or Homaya, I don't know how to pronounce it, out of New York City. And they make a product called Homaya Sambal Chili Crunch. So they got a cease and desist. And they also talked to Caleb Wang and Jen Liao of Mila, out of Seattle, who make, they primarily make soup dumplings apparently, but they, recently kind of reworked and rebranded, their chili crisp, into chili crunch. And so these are examples of people who have received the cease and desist.
I see.
The, trademark bully quote comes from one of the lawyers who's defending, one of the people who received the letter. And, yeah, the article talks a lot about, like the reason that people are, upset about it is because Momofuku and Chang, like it's a huge organization with like loads of venture capital behind it. And, you know, they did, according to the article, $20 million of sales in 2023. Whereas a lot of the companies that have received the cease and desist, some of them have had, VC, help as well, but like some of them are like two or three employee companies, yeah. that, so it's seen as like a Goliath picking on David kind of situation. Right. But to me, the interesting thing is that first of all, Momofuku does actually have the trademark rights to Chile Crunch. Like it's the US Patent and Trademark Office. It is registered as a trademark.
Right.
Interestingly, they acquired that trademark, after they were accused of trademark infringement from the previous owner, I think it was Colonial. Oh shoot, I should look that up. Colonial Chile out of Colorado or something like that. And
it's
they
a good name for a business.
It's a different time. And also oh maybe lands differently in the States than it does in Canada, but
I understand why I understand that there's like a little bit of like a cultural difference for the word colonial in the States, but it still means the same thing.
Sorry, the company was called Chile Colonial. Out of Denver, and they had a product for years that they called Chile Crunch, and it was like a Mexican version of Chili Crisp. And after some legal dispute, Momofuku actually bought the rights from them. So they do have the rights to Chile Crunch. And so to me, like whatever you think about Chang and stuff, like if he has the legal right to like the legal trademark of the term, then I don't see why I'd get upset with him by enforcing it. But however, they do not have trademark rights to Chili Crunch yet.
Right.
But they applied about a week ago on March 29th. They applied to have it registered. And so I don't know anything about trademark law, obviously, but I imagine that sending a cease and desist to someone who's using a term that you're about to apply for trademark rights to, I imagine that's kind of part and parcel of the process. Like you're soon going to have to go in front of the USPTO and make a claim that your term represents a distinct product. And so, yeah, it seems like that would help your case if you've already sent out cease and desist letters and a few of the recipients have acquiesced or whatever. Like, I don't know. I assume it's a common practice, but yeah, it's for these small companies that clearly will not be able to put up money for a legal team to defend their case. That's kind of what the story hinges around. That's basically how the story, I mean, just the fact that they use the term trademark bully in the title, that's kind of what the Guardian piece is about. Yeah. It's not an unbiased piece. Although that being said, Momofuku didn't respond to their request for comments. So.
Okay, I have a couple questions for you, Alan.
Yeah.
In the Guardian piece, is there any indication of, like, the two companies that they're talking about who have been sent cease and desists as to whether they were using the term before Momofuku started using it or...
Okay, so for the Mila product, that one, because they used to sell it as Chili Crisp, and then they specifically reworked it to have a different texture, and so called it Chili Crunch.
Because crisp and crunch, those are two things that everyone understands the difference between. But yeah,
well, I mean, but I mean, it does sound different, right? Like, or it does make you think of something a little bit different, I think.
Yeah, it makes everyone think of something a little bit different. What that difference is completely subjective, I feel like.
But, right.
Yeah.
So they don't actually say, unless I've missed it, I don't think that they tell us the date that they reworked their product and rebranded it as Chili Crunch. I think it's implied that because Momofuku, I believe, started, quote, and here's another tricky thing. In the article, they say that Momofuku started, quote, offering Chili Crunch in 2018, but they didn't actually put them on sale until 2020. Now, what that means, I don't actually know, but I think maybe
you could pick it up in the restaurant, but it wasn't available at retail or something like that.
Right. Something like that. Yeah. And so that I think they're implying that the Mila product was formulated after that for the Homaya.
I mean,
product,
that would be the implication that you would want to make if you were trying to build a trademark case. Right.
Right. But, I think that, again, like, obviously I'm out of my depth here. It's not just who said it first. It's questions like, are these other companies trying to confuse the public about, like, are they purposefully imitating the Momofuku brand?
Exactly.
And also, is this even a term that can be trademarked? You would, the obvious, sorry, the intuitive answer to me as an outsider would be that, of course, if Chile Crunch can be trademarked, I don't see why Chili Crunch couldn't be. However, they do give an interesting kind of tangent. There's a chef named Jing Gao, who has a company called Fly by Jing, and they make a product called Fly by Jing Sichuan Chili Crisp. And Gao actually says that he applied to have Sichuan Chili Crisp trademarked, but it was refused by the USPTO because it was merely descriptive. So I don't know. It seems to me like their requirements for trademark rights are applied inconsistently, because Sichuan Chili Crisp sounds at least as distinct as Chile Crunch, but it's not my job. But
yeah, well, the only reason why there's a difference there, the reason why that inconsistency exists is because someone may have a big enough legal team to, what's the word, to appeal a decision like that if it doesn't go in their favor, whereas someone else may not feel like they have enough money to hire enough lawyers to appeal a decision like that. I mean, if Microsoft can trademark the word Windows, I feel like, it's more of like a cost thing than it is a consistent legal thing. But yeah.
They don't say what year Colonial Chile had Chile Crunch trademarked, but it could be that if it were, say, in the 70s or 80s, and I don't know if that's the case, that this would be, it would have seemed like such a fringe niche phrase to trademark that it might have just been easily granted, whereas now with dozens of different chili, crispy, crunchy things in supermarkets, it seems a little bit more pressing now, I guess, about who gets to say what. But interesting. I don't know. I feel like there is a general, in the food community, Chang is increasingly perceived as something like a sellout, or as he's not perceived the same way as he was the year that he won the James Beard Award for best new chef or best New York chef or whatever it was, because he's pushed so far into business and even though this was always part of his thinking, like he's pushed so far into convenience products and stuff like that, like his,
yeah,
his perception has changed. And it'll, like, I don't know, to me, it's a legal thing and I don't really see him differently, but
yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I think it's like, there's a few things there, I don't want to be, I don't really want to be on either side in this situation, but it feels like anathema to my personal politics to be on the side of Goliath in the David and Goliath scenario.
Right.
And I'm not really, I think that, for these smaller companies that probably are having no impact on Momofuku's brand recognition, mm-hmm. that it would be just a better call to just not worry about this trademark infringement.
Right.
Unfortunately, like what I do understand about trademark law is that if you don't make any effort to enforce trademark infringement, so if there is a product out there, if you own the trademark for something and there's a product out there that calls itself the same thing and you don't make any effort to enforce your trademark against that potential infringer, mm-hmm. then your trademark loses its validity in terms of the legal power to be able to enforce it.
Right.
Yeah. And so it's not like in court, you have a harder time fighting for your trademark if you have avoided enforcing it mm-hmm. in the past. So if there are companies that are known to you who are infringing on your trademark, if you don't do something about that, if a larger company comes along who really can harm the recognition of your product by calling their product the same thing, and then you go to court against that actor and try to defend your trademark, they can use the fact that you didn't defend it previously as an argument in their legal case to, mm-hmm. for them to win, the trademark case or whatever. And so if you own a trademark and don't defend it, it's kind of just as good as not owning it, which
that's right.
It's yeah. messed up. And because it sucks.
The whole reason that you're granted the trademark in the first place is that because it your product and your term is distinct and valuable. And so if you mm-hmm. haven't defended it, then it means that it's not valuable to you. yeah. It's kind of funny, but yeah, that's kind of the reasoning behind it.
Yeah. And so, I it's easy to spin a David and Goliath narrative around that, Mm-hmm. And then it's easy as well, because David Chang is the head of, or the face of Momofuku, mm-hmm. It's then easy to associate the narrative that you've spun around that company being a bully with that single person. And I don't know one way or the other, whether, maybe the Chang was the one who was like, these people are using our name. I don't know. Maybe. that's entirely possible. And if that's the case, that's unfortunate. And that would, and knowing that would probably make me see Chang differently. But not knowing any of that, it's hard for me to invest in this narrative that David Chang is a bully or something. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, it's not really my place to comment and not really what we're here to talk about, but mm-hmm. this is a news article from The Guardian that uses quoted inflammatory remarks, namely trademark bully, instead of actually just reporting mm-hmm. on the story, which the actual headline, it could be Momofuku sends cease and desist letters to other companies using chili crunch.
Exactly.
That would be a much more balanced journalistic approach, but that's just kind of the state of journalism now maybe. But we might not be talking about it if we hadn't been so incensed by this bullied. But anyways, that's another conversation, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And I think editorializing in that way is what sort of turns it into a story. In general, I think that,
it implies a, it enforces a narrative or forces a narrative onto how we perceive what's happening. And
trademark law is just like, you know, like whether it should exist or not is just sort of like a cultural, like
it's just like your opinion, man.
I mean, you can have your own opinion about it, but you know, the extent to which that the opinion that it should or should not exist becomes prevalent is like, you know, a cultural thing around money and intellectual property and people's power to earn money and protect their earnings and things like that. And those are all, you know, balanced by the extent to which capitalism is worshipped in any particular culture. And so, you know, it's, I would say it's a pretty complicated issue, and I don't, you know, I'm not really well enough informed to have a real opinion about it. You know, I have heard things about Chang in the past that paint him in not so great a light either. And so, you know, it doesn't really, wouldn't necessarily surprise me to know that, you know, he's like violently defending a trademark that for a thing he didn't even come up with the idea for. But, you know, at the same time, I'm just not well enough informed to really comment on it either way. And, you know, like, if I felt like the thing that he was protecting was like a miracle product, then I don't know, maybe I would
feel different.
Yeah, maybe I would feel differently, but you know, the product's pretty mid, so.
Oh my goodness. I can't believe you just said that.
Which I believe is what I said in the episode that we talked about. It needs help. You know, you need to put something else with it to make it to make it into a good lunch.
Oh, you're talking about noodles though.
Yes.
Sorry, not the chili crunch.
Not the chili, not the chili crunch.
I thought you were coming after
not,
the chili
crunch.
Not
the chili crunch.
I thought you were.
No, I haven't tried the chili crunch.
Chili crunch. The Momofuku product is chili crunch, not chile crunch. Oh, okay. They just happen to own the trademark rights to chile crunch
for
as
chile
well.
Crunch. Oh, yeah. Okay. Sorry. I misunderstood.
Okay.
But hopefully soon they'll own both. So
I want to have like
have a legal leg to stand on.
A 6-month moratorium on talking about David Chang, even mentioning him. Just because he comes up a disproportionate amount of time compared to the real effect he has on my everyday life. So
yeah, me too. Yeah, totally. Although I'm a little bit worried that once we start talking about Rene Redzepi, we're going to run into David Chang again.
Oh.
I know. I know they have some professional associations. So,
business? You just mean that?
Well,
Redzepi shows up on Mind of a Chef every once in a while.
Right? Yeah. Well, yeah. I think like they sort of were both kind of involved in Mad Food.
Oh, okay.
Conference or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay,
that's what I'm referring to.
Let's move on.
Anyway. Yeah, let's move on. Yeah, I hope those companies don't get crushed by the weight of
we just agreed to move on. Why are we going back?
Because there was one more thing that I was going to say.
Okay.
That I didn't really get to say. It sounds like in the article, when you say that Momofuku has $20 million in revenue, like obviously that's a large amount of money. To an individual.
Right.
But for like a business. So, and that's also like a really large amount of money to like an independent restaurateur or something like that. Right. Like that's a lot of revenue for someone with a few restaurants or something like that. Like really large, you know, probably that's probably like the most successful independent restaurateurs in America, that might be, you know, their revenue might be approaching something like that. But for like a retail company that's doing business internationally, you know, it doesn't really seem like they're a giant. It kind of still seems to me like they're a little bit of an underdog. And, you know, like we're not talking about hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, you know, like we're talking about enough money to sustain a business where maybe 100 people could be employed or something like that. Like maybe 100, maybe a couple hundred or something like that. Like that's, it's not a gigantic conglomerate or something like that. And so I think it's a little bit of a mischaracterization in that way as well. You know, yes, they are bigger than these other companies that they're suing, but you know, they're not like, I don't think that, you know, they, I don't think that you could say that like they're so big that they can't fail or that, you know, they're right. inevitably successful or that they can afford like all the lawyers in the world, like, like a, you know.
So it's not David versus Goliath. It's David versus his older brother.
Kind of. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I was like 6 month moratorium on talking about David Chang. And then we agreed to move on. And then 5 seconds later, you had to talk about it. I'm just kidding.
This is the one where Alan quits the podcast.
You might be right. And again, it's more like the narrative that the Guardian piece is telling. It gives the investment numbers and the sales numbers as if it's propping Momofuku up as a giant. And you're, surely there is some level of disproportion between Momofuku, and especially because they're, Chang's involvement in media means that they, like, it's kind of like a vicious cycle where to apply for the patent and, or sorry, for the trademark and receive the trademark, they need to show that, you know, it's received a lot of publicity, but Chang is kind of already in that environment, in that space, in a way that the others aren't. So
it's easier for them to prove that.
Yeah. But anyways, yeah, someone who's not, doesn't know as much about economics might just read that and assume that the Guardian is saying that, yeah, he's, you know, orders of magnitude bigger than these other companies.
Yeah. Like he might an unstoppable not be. Force of business or something right. like that, which, you know, yeah, again, it's just a little bit of an editorial take, I feel like. But
Anyways, it's really interesting, and I'm glad that Larry pointed it out, because I had missed that one, so thank you.
Yeah, and I knew nothing about it until he pointed it out, and then later on, I started seeing stuff pop up on TikTok about it and stuff like that. So it's, you know, it's a narrative that is definitely like out there gaining some momentum and stuff like that. So I'm glad he brought it up to us, because I, you know, it's interesting.
I'll have to check. I didn't look, but I assume that the Sussman's account will have some hilarious take on it too.
So. Yeah, I'm sure you're right. Yeah.
Okay.
I guess we're gonna have to do a Sussman's part two sometime. Hey.
I don't know. Maybe.
Okay, moving on, I promise.
We'll see.
Yeah.
And another thing.
Listen here, Chang. Okay. What are we going to talk about today, Alan?
I feel
up until yesterday, we didn't really have a topic, and then I spur of the moment. Something occurred to me that I don't know that we've really talked about on the show before, but that we both kind of have some experience with. So I thought it might be fun to dive into it a little bit. I don't really have a structure for this conversation or anything like that, but Alan and I have both worked in like full service restaurants, and we've also both done quite a bit of work in catering. And then we both have some experience, obviously, cooking for ourselves or our family, and then also cooking like big meals for like family get-togethers and things like that. And I think there's some interesting parallels there. I think there's like a parallel between cooks who have mainly worked in like a short order restaurant or like an a la carte restaurant, doing catering for the first time. It's sort of like a different style of cooking with a different set of concerns. And like home cooks who may be like very good at cooking for one or two or four people, who then have to extend that to cooking for like 12 or 20 people. It's just sort of like a different set of planning problems that you have to solve. And it can be disastrous, I think, if you don't really understand what the concerns are there. And I just thought it would be fun to talk about like some of the differences there.
Okay.
Yeah. And so what are our bona fides, Alan?
What?
Alan and I both worked for Elm Catering for quite a while, and both of us were the chef of the catering operation for that company at different times. And so we did a lot of pretty big events. I don't know what would I think probably for me the biggest event that I ever did was probably a multi-course dinner for 300, like slightly over 300 people or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Trying to remember if I did anything bigger than that, but I think that's probably the biggest thing.
The biggest one that happened while I was the chef there was, it was a multi-day conference at the University of Alberta. Friday night and went through Sunday lunch. Maybe it wasn't on a weekend, but it was a 3-day event that we catered multiple meal services for, and some of them were upwards of 700 guests. That was not common for us at all, and that really pushed all of our staff and infrastructure to the brink. But that was the largest one we did. I would say a more typical catering service, there was two styles. We would do like drop off lunch catering for corporate environments, like sandwiches and salads and things like that. And then for a dinner service, it varied a lot, but I would say it was very common for us, say like in July, August, September, to cater weddings of 100 people or less.
Right.
That was kind of the meat and potatoes. Those two, corporate lunch drop offs and, mid-sized, 50, 80, 100 guests for a dinner service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I mean, how would you say that preparing food for something like that is different than preparing food in a restaurant? Like, what are the fundamental differences?
So the biggest difference is that you're in a different space for almost every service. Obviously, you have repeat customers and everything, but you have to be much more adaptable. You're moving to different locations. That involves way more planning for the cooking, but also on the service side. Understanding the guest expectations, the space. Every time you're doing an event, you're doing some kind of setup from scratch, usually. Like, it's not like you're going into a restaurant and using their dining room. You're usually going into a community hall or a boardroom or something and setting up what they need. And so obviously you develop systems and templates and things like that, but really the event planner, every single time a new client reaches out, we have to kind of start from scratch and say, okay, what's the room? How many people?
Yeah.
Where is the food going to go? What do they want?
Do we have access to electricity? Do we have access to water?
Yeah. So on the cooking side, oftentimes, I mean, I don't know how common this is really, but like oftentimes we were doing meal services in places that didn't even have full service kitchens. There would have to be running water for us, obviously, but we're not working on gas ranges. You're working typically, you're either bringing in food hot and it's like in a box that's keeping it hot, or reheating. Sometimes you're in a residential kitchen, you're in someone's home cooking for them. You're bringing in induction burners. You're just kind of piecing together the service kitchen on site, with whatever is available based on where the event's going to be held, based on what kind of food you're serving and what you have in your, you know, in your company, what tools you have and equipment you have to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And so because the logistics are ever changing and much more complicated than a typical restaurant service, oftentimes that is informing your menu design, right? And so for instance,
exactly. That's sort of exactly what I was going to follow up with.
Yeah. Like your menu design is taking its lead from what equipment and space you'll have on site. Whereas with a restaurant, it should be the brand and the customer, what you're trying to sell takes a little bit, you know, you start with that and then you figure out how you're going to, what equipment you're going to need and be able to purchase and stuff like that. Is that a good starting point? I don't know. What else?
Yeah, I think so. I would say, that's exactly right. Is that like, you know, the food that, and you know, like in the case of a lot of the catering that we were doing, we were often doing custom menus for each event. But I know that like a lot of, like those custom menus were built off a lot of staples. that we, and they were like generally the type of staples that offer the kind of flexibility that you need to be able to replicate them with the quality that is necessary to make them worthwhile, in lots of different types of circumstances. And, you know, and then also keeping in mind that you don't want to necessarily just rely on foods that can, sit at a certain temperature for an hour and not degrade in quality or whatever. You still want to be able to, you still want to be able to serve things that are fresh and that are going to give people sort of like a, you know, a more enjoyable, a more memorable dining experience. But you have to figure out ways to do that, where you're, you know, where like the transportation and the limitations of the preparation environment aren't going to impact the quality of the product. So I would say like some, like I would say the fundamental things that are really different is that all of the food has to be considered, or the menu has to be considered in a way that allows for offsite transportation. That's like a big one, you know. You don't have to worry about that in a restaurant. The raw ingredients come in after you've prepared or like, you know, turned them into your mise en place or are turning them into a dish. They have to, you know, be carried on a plate from a window to a diner. You know, that's the, that's sort of like the most transportation that they have to go undergo. I don't know. Like, I know that that's changed a lot in recent years where like probably 50% of most restaurants, customers are ordering from home, but,
right. Depending.
But still, I think, you know, in the case of catering, that's just sort of like a primary concern. Go ahead.
So, like one thing that kind of touches on that, obviously catering can be anything. You can do all kinds of different services and serve all kinds of different food. But the, one of the huge differences is that when we say, when we think about restaurant service, we're almost always talking about a la carte or a tasting menu. But typically for catering, we're either talking about a banquet style service or a buffet style service.
A buffet,
And so that's another thing, like just the timing and the production flow of an a la carte service. It means like, even if you have a 50 person restaurant, if you have a small grill, like the, you know, you're only getting grilled items ordered a few at a time. Whereas typically with catering, you're serving the entire group at once. Cause usually it's some kind of event like a wedding or a meeting or whatever. And so then your scale really messes things up. So like even with a barbecue or a modestly sized grill, like it's very difficult to grill 50 steaks at once. And so you, but you actually have a surprising amount of, wiggle room with people's perception of value. So like cooks understand how much more difficult it would be to grill 50 steaks for a banquet at once compared to say braising 50 portions of short rib in advance and hot holding it and transporting it to site, or even cooking a roast and then carving it into steaks. Cooks understand the difference and perceive them as different value-added amounts. A lot of people don't really understand that distinction. And a lot of people are as happy to receive a properly braised piece of short rib as they are, you know, a filet mignon pan roasted to order or whatever. And that's what, at least in our operation, like we would leverage that a lot. Like as long as it's a perfectly braised, seasoned, flavorful, saucy bit of short rib, people love it. People go crazy for it. And some people who don't understand the difference between that and a grilled steak would comment like, this is the most tender piece of meat I've ever had. Sorry, do you know what I mean? Like, but it's a completely different cut of meat, a completely different process, but people love it. And it works really well for those events.
Yeah. And I would say that that second fundamental difference, like, whereas, you know, in an a la carte service, you are having orders come in a staggered way. And so, you know, if your kitchen is set up right, you're not going to overwhelm the infrastructure of your kitchen as the orders come in. Whereas in a banquet style or a buffet style service, yes, everyone needs to be served all at once. And I think that that fundamental difference is also, you know, that's sort of like the nugget of the difference between, you know, cooking dinner for your family on a nightly and cooking like a bunch of food for, you know, like a Christmas dinner or something like that.
Yeah,
that's
exactly,
sort of like the fundamental difference there is that like, when you are just cooking a few things for your family, the time that it takes to prepare something isn't so great that if you start one thing after the other, the one thing isn't going to be cold by the time the other is finished necessarily or something like that. It just doesn't take as much sort of like pre-planning to make sure that the food comes up all at the same time. But, you know, once you get into cooking for 12, 15, 20 people or more, that becomes like a much more challenging kind of task. And, you know, I think in a lot of cases, you know, like if you're, you know, cooking a holiday meal or something like that, you know, maybe it doesn't really matter if something on the table gets cold or whatever, but it kind of does matter if you have a whole bunch of people sitting around a table waiting for a meal to be served.
Yes.
And, you know, it's coming up like one dish every 10 minutes and it takes an hour for it to hit the table. I feel like,
yeah,
you know, people can get impatient. And
so I think just to parse it out a bit, to me, the two biggest things that can either improve a professional cook's catering game compared to their restaurant game, and also a home cook's large group service like Thanksgiving versus a Tuesday night with your spouse. Mm-hmm. The two things are understanding, first of all, what can be made a day or days before.
Yeah.
And
thank you, Best of Bridge.
And what can't, yeah, exactly. Well, no, that's exactly right. And then what is thermally stable? What can be preheated and hot held on the day of service? And so to use the Thanksgiving dinner the Thanksgiving dinner example, you think of all the staples of a Thanksgiving dinner, almost all of it can to some degree be prepped the day or days out. Like mashed potatoes, there's absolutely no reason, especially for, maybe it's different in a very high-end restaurant, but for the purposes of a traditional Thanksgiving dinner, mashed potatoes 100% can and should be made the day before.
Yeah.
Stuffing, depending on how it's being made, can be mixed and in a casserole and in a fridge the night before. Gravy can be made, definitely can be made a day in advance, as long as it's not relying on the dripping. If it's relying on the drippings of the turkey, then yes, maybe that should be made day of. But
even though I would say, like, so for instance, you know, like,
I need to say that I know that gravy is definitionally reliant on the drippings of the meat. I just need to say that.
That's fair. There's lots of room for you to say that.
Okay, good. I just feel like someone at work might hear that and say, this man doesn't know what gravy is, and then take my job away.
Yeah, that's fair. I think that you can, like, you know, because most gravy isn't going to rely solely on the pan drippings. And so I think that what you can do is, like, if you have stock from the animal or something like that the day before, you can make the gravy up to the point where, you know, you've used the stock and you've mixed it with the roux and it's like basically ready to go, and you just need the flavor enhancement of the drippings. Like, you can introduce the drippings in a different way than using the fond and the same pan that the drippings are in. So, you know, I think that you can still get that and make the gravy a day ahead.
But it means that when it's crunch time and people are starting to arrive and asking how they can help, it's a difference between having, you know, all your burners full and your oven full and a sink full of dishes compared to like an hour or two before people arrive. You slide the pre-made casserole of mashed potatoes and stuffing and all that into the oven, and then it frees you up to focus on the things where the quality really is different if it's prepared more or less at the last minute. So making sure that freshly roasted meat is a lot different than leftovers compared to braises, which can be made in advance and then rethermed and maybe even are better than they were the day that they were first made. So the turkey would be something that you're starting to roast that afternoon. What would be it for a Thanksgiving dinner, besides turkey and gravy? What would be another example of like a last minute kind of thing where the detectable quality or eating experience is improved by doing it after guests have arrived?
I don't know how closely this adheres to the traditional Thanksgiving dinner kind of meal idea, but definitely any kind of salad, you know.
Right.
So any kind of salad, you wouldn't really want to be, you would want to hold off dressing it until like kind of the very last minute. You can pre-prepare a lot of the ingredients. You can pre-cut the greens for it if that's what you're going to use or whatever, but you would make the dressing ahead, obviously. And if you were making like a Caesar salad or something, you would make the croutons ahead and things like that.
I would qualify that and say green salad, because there's a lot of salads, right? Like if we're thinking of other large services,
yeah,
like
I
say
an ambrosia salad,
like a summer barbecue where you're feeding a lot of people, make the potato salad the day before, definitely.
Potato salad, macaroni salad, ambrosia salad,
hot dog salad,
great day before, hot dog salad.
But for me, like for Thanksgiving, like pie would be an example. Like you can make it the day before, but depending on the style of pie, it's probably better if you bake it that morning or that afternoon. Like the crust will be noticeably
crispier,
more delicate
and
crispy. So that's something, but again, like to parse out each of these preparations and individual tasks, like the pie dough should be made a week before. Do you know what I mean? Like you make it a week before and put it in the freezer, and take it out the night before, dinner. The filling, depending on what it is, if it's pumpkin or sour cherry or whatever, like that can, if it's a cooked filling, it can be made, the day before. And so we always have sour cherry pie at Thanksgiving. So that filling is always cooked the day before. Whereas, I don't know, apple pie, you don't want to run the risk of oxidizing the apples if they sit in the fridge overnight. So maybe I would do that the day of. But for me, those are the two big ones, the turkey and gravy, and the pies for Thanksgiving. Those are things that I'm definitely cooking day of. But
on the day.
Yeah, having these kind of mise en place or things done in advance.
Yeah. Well, you know me, Alan. I found a way around the turkey one. So that's...
With your circulator, is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm always cooking the turkey sous vide so that basically I can do it the day before. There are still touches that need to be done on the day, including whatever interaction it has with the gravy and also crisping up the skin. But I just feel like I have much more time and I'm much more confident to be able to put up the meal without, you know, or like in a stress-free way if I know that, you know, the turkey is kind of taken care of.
Right. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Having this conversation is kind of like making me or giving me flashbacks to the fishes episode there.
Right. Yes, exactly. That was not a well thought out prep for such a complicated meal service. Yeah. And that's,
I feel, and I don't know, like I'm a little bit like, I understand that their mom was like very particular and she wanted to do everything her way and she didn't want really, she was kind of averse to having people give her a hand, even though she said she needed help. You know, the help that she wanted was like, you know, for no one to interfere with, how she was cooking all of the things that she traditionally cooked a certain way or whatever. But I feel like Carmi should have had a lot of things that he could have offered gently to her as a way to like make her life a lot easier. And it seemed like he was not, you know, really thinking about that too much.
Right.
Yeah.
To kind of try and generalize this. So we said, you know, for catering or for cooking for large groups at home, understanding what can be pre-made and what can be hot held are important. To kind of try and generalize that, you also have to understand what freezes well. And so for instance, like, and this is very much in an a la carte restaurant setting, but another it's the same kind of goal of just making sure that production happens as efficiently as possible and you don't run out of product, but understanding what can be made in large batches and frozen without any perceptible deterioration in quality. And so example, right. We have loads of say like, or anytime we have a starchy appetizer, like gnocchi, certain kinds of pasta, pierogies, you know, this one's kind of obvious to people who cook at home, but like being able to make those en masse, have them in the freezer, and you can kind of keep your inventories. And like, you know that when you reach a certain quantity on hand, you'd have to do another batch, but it means you're not doing it every day. You're not even necessarily doing it every week.
Right.
And it can help you focus on the consistency and quality when you do have those large batches to make.
My Nona would be pretty mad that you're not making your gnocchi every day.
But... well, fair enough. Yeah. But I mean, yeah, like it's the kind of thing that perhaps at Uccellino, someone would notice if it was pre-made and frozen, but for a catering event, a wedding for 100, most people will not notice, and they'll be, you can still make something very delicious. And the other thing kind of in the same vein, working items into your menu that can be pre-made and just kept in dry storage. So
crispy garnishes.
Or yeah, exactly. Like so like in our, example of offsite catering where we're using things that are very thermally stable and can be made in advance, like say we're doing braised short rib and buttermilk mashed potatoes and stuff like that, that almost always is a soft moist preparation that holds well in a thermal cabinet. And so what we're missing is texture. And so if you just eat all that, if you just serve all that, it might be very tasty, might be flavorful and well seasoned, but we don't have any textural interest right now. But if we have crispy, like you said, crispy components that can be just brought dry storage, we're not worried about refrigeration or hot holding, things like lovely like crispy fried root vegetables or shallots or garlic chips or whatever it is, that's a way just to like improve the eating experience without having to do things a la minute and worry about storage and equipment and things like that. And again, even in a restaurant setting,
I mean, those things are great for an a la carte restaurant as well, but almost like I would say more necessary in a catering situation. You know, they're like a great addition to a lot of a la carte plates, but there's a lot of ways that you can get those same sort of like flavor or textural things when you're doing things a la carte. But for catering, like that's something you kind of need to rely on, dehydrating things or frying things crispy or something like that.
Yeah. And we have a lot of the, like a lot of things like that, even on the menu at Ernest's right now. And we've talked about lots of them, like the crispy fried root vegetables on the mushroom soup and stuff. And I do think that, we've kind of talked about this, like, relating to the microwave. Like I don't want to, you know, sometimes if you put too much stuff in the microwave, people start to think you're a hack cook, but same with the freezers, even though I felt like I needed to backtrack and say, oh, well maybe at Uccellino they would never freeze their gnocchi. I distinctly remember, a moment in that 7 days out episode about 11 Madison Park, when the chef de cuisine, when they're working towards their grand reopening, he's like, we've got to get our freezers back on track. We've got to get, you know, all of our, obviously ice creams and sorbets, but like all of our crumbles and all of these things, like these kind of crispy garnishes they use on savory dishes. We've got to get our freezer like loaded with those because right now our freezer is not on track. So it is, you have, like I said, way more wiggle room than... You can make your life a lot easier by trying to think these things through and really ask yourself seriously, like, what is this going to compromise the eating quality? And if it doesn't, then do it. It's fine.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and for some things, like you were saying, like, you know, like frozen garnishes and things like that, it's absolutely necessary, right? Like, and there are a lot of like garnishes or things like that that are, you know, that the only way to prepare them properly is like some kind of freezing technique or something like that. And you know, that's just, it's just another tool in your arsenal. Nothing wrong with freezing things. I think that oftentimes it's sort of associated with like a degradation in quality when things are frozen versus fresh or something like that. But that's, you know, it's certainly not what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Understand. Yeah. And another example, well, and this relates to, you know, yeah, what can be pre-made. Understanding how long something will last in the fridge without deterioration in freshness in terms of eating quality. And then really severely and explicitly parsing out the production steps. So, and I'll give you an example. Like at June's, we had a buckwheat blintz as a brunch item.
Right.
So it's a buckwheat kind of crepe that's folded around a cottage cheese filling. And so instead of on our prep list, instead of just saying, you know, buckwheat blintz, we had it parsed out into a whole series of prep tasks. And one was making the filling. One was making not just the crepes, but the batter for the crepes, making the crepes, assembling the full blintz. So at any given time in our cooler, we have fully assembled, like filled and tidily folded, neatly wrapped blintzes ready to be popped into a pan to be seared. We also have fully made crepes on hand. We have fully made filling and we have fully made batter for the crepes.
Yeah.
And so instead of it being like, okay, well, we've only got 10 blintzes left. We better, you know, start making filling and start making the batter and do you know what I mean? Yeah, and making everything from scratch. It's like this continuous system where it's like, well, we know once we get down to our last liter of filling, we got to make filling. Even if we're 3 days away from having to assemble more blintzes, we'll make the filling now. Oh, we've just cooked the last of the crepes. So let's make batter because we know the batter will last for 4 or 5 days in the fridge, no problem. And it just, from a production flow standpoint, it was seamless because on any given day, there's really only one small task you need to keep this kind of stockpile of usable goods in place.
Yeah, that's sort of what, like, I think the point that you're making is like a better way of illustrating kind of what I was talking about when I was talking about making ramen from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, making 4 bowls of ramen from scratch is like an extremely long and laborious process. But for some reason, making ramen every day for a restaurant is seemingly sort of less laborious than that.
Yes.
And the reason why is because you have all of these things in various states of readiness.
Mm-hmm.
And so the things that take 3 days to prepare, you know, you always have day one, day two, and day three of that product on hand, ready to go.
Right.
Whereas if you're starting from scratch, you need all 3 days to get that product where it needs to be before you can continue preparing it or whatever. And so, yeah, it's sort of like that, that like breaking things down into like a regimented schedule wherein you have like the varying stages of completeness always on hand makes things feel a little bit less, I don't know, intimidating or just like easier to manage.
And that, well, that makes me think about there are certain food service operations where they say explicitly, we make this every day. And so that's why, if we run out at 1 o'clock, it's because we make it every morning. And can you think of examples where that might actually be really important? So like ramen, I can't imagine. Like stock is something, and maybe it's just the tradition that I'm from, but like we make stock at work in 30 liter batches roughly, and then use it over a week and then make it again. And maybe we freeze some, but usually it's like we make it in really large batches. There's no application that I can think of in like the French, like this culinary school tradition where it would be beneficial for us to make the stock the day that we're going to use it. But can you think of examples where it's like critical, not just for a like marketing and branding, like, oh, like it sounds cool if you make it every day from scratch, but like where it actually affects eating quality, where like, no, it really does need to be fresh and made that day.
Only in terms of like ingredients that are basically live.
Okay.
You know, so like herbs or garnishes or greens for green salads, or in some cases, maybe seafood. Although, you know, like there's a sort of like a myth that, you know, the fresher you get your sushi, the better it is. And that's not necessarily true. Like, you know, some things need to be aged to have their best flavor and texture and things like that. Same with meats, you know, right. Like meat cutting, you know, there's a perception that, you know, like as the fresher your steak is, the better it's going to be. But, you know, that's like clearly not true when you look at things like dry aging and stuff like that. Mm.
There's a good example, like from not pop culture, but like popular food media. I think of Le Bernardin. That's something that's part of their ethos is like, or sorry, part of their story is that every single morning at whatever it is, 4 or 5 in the morning, all of the fish that they will serve that day comes to the restaurant and it all gets processed and all gets served. And then the next day they do it all again. That's something.
Yeah. My suspicion is that like the seafood that they receive is like pre-aged by their purveyor in some cases.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not, you know, that's not like, how they, like, I don't know. Does fish benefit from aging the same way that red meat and stuff does?
Not like one-to-one, like what it would be for like meat, not in a dry aging sense, I don't think, but like, yeah, like I've heard several renowned sushi chefs say that, like, you know, tuna is better, you know, in this block of time after it was caught and processed or something, you know.
I think for that,
and I think a lot of that has, a lot of that has to do with like how after the animal dies, like there are hormones and all types of things in the meat that either need to break down or be processed or redistribute in some way, so that, you know, so that the meat isn't tough or things like that. Like there are several sorts of, you know, varying ways of treating fish that, you know, for certain fish make the texture and flavor better or whatever.
I'm sure that.
So it's just not like, you know, it's just like, I don't think that if you started to dig in at Le Bernardin and look at the actual like way that things are processed, I'm sure that some fish is like not caught the morning of and some is maybe or something.
Yeah, I could certainly see it. They never say that it's caught that morning. They just say that it comes into the building. Yeah, yeah. So I could see, I don't actually know anything about it, but I could see that being say for bluefin tuna or something. Like obviously that's a massive fish that they're selecting certain, almost like beef, not quite, but almost like beef, where they're selecting certain parts of it for different applications. And perhaps it would, and it's a very dark meat. I could see maybe, age really affecting that, but then something more like, I don't know, like sole or skate. I don't know about that. Like to me, that does seem
like
something
that you would catch it and like an hour later, you'd be ready to serve it or something. And I think it's very different for like raw or cooked or something like that, how you treat it.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anyway, I feel like we got a little bit off track there getting into the weeds with how much you should age sole. But, you know, I think in general, you know, getting back to the sort of like the catering side of things, you know, the fundamentals, I guess, are that A, you need to plan for transportation and flexibility, and B, you need to, what was B?
Knowing what equipment you'll have?
No.
Oh, okay.
Oh, sorry. So A... So A is understanding that you need to plan for transportation and flexibility. And two is understanding that everyone needs to eat at the same time. Those are the big fundamental differences, I think. And so, you know, like giving yourself the flexibility to be able to prepare food that you are going to be able to serve to a large number of people all at the same time, you know, that kind of like helps give you the flexibility to be able to serve that food also in different logistical circumstances. So like with different types of cooking equipment in different settings, you know, maybe you have a kitchen, maybe you don't, maybe you have access to an oven, maybe you don't. And just like trying to make a plan that gives yourself the flexibility to be able to do that. I mean, you know, in a lot of cases, you would have a pretty good idea of what your cooking situation is going to be like on site before you go there. But I have to say that also, it's not uncommon for you to be like nearly certain of all of the infrastructure that you're going to have when you go to a specific catering site. Mm-hmm. And then for you to get there and one of those assumptions to not prove correct. Right. Like, even if you've gone to the site before and inspected the equipment and seen the path from where the food is going to be delivered to the customers and really planned everything out, you know, it's fairly safe to assume that just in just about every case of catering, that just about every catering job that I have ever done, that when you get there, something won't be like what you expected it to be.
Yes.
Something won't be working or something like that. And so you always need to have a backup plan,
mm-hmm.
For how you might prepare something, or you always need to be a little bit mentally prepared to solve some kind of infrastructure problem once you arrive on site.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to a certain extent, that's true of a restaurant too, but it's just a completely different order of magnitude for catering. The unknown variables. And then to me, one of the risks, or like one of the things that I struggled with, was the balance between mitigating logistics and transportation, or like having so much contingency built into that while still offering food that seems fresh and interesting, because mm-hmm. it's easy to just kind of like, well, like I've said, you know, short rib and mashed potatoes, I know that's not a home run, but I know that we can do that really well. But am I going to serve short rib and mashed potatoes every catering service for the rest of my life? It might not be a big deal if you're really like just, you're always having new, if every time you serve, it's almost always for a new audience, but like for repeat customers, that becomes problematic, right?
And especially when you're talking about the type of event that you were talking about, where you are serving multiple meals over like several days to the same people, mm-hmm. you can't serve short rib and mashed potato for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for three straight days. Yeah. People will probably get a little annoyed.
Exactly. And actually, that was one of the most difficult catering projects I ever did was, sorry, not the one you just mentioned, but one of the very first ones I did just a couple years out of culinary school was catering a film set over the course of production. And so it was,
oh, really?
Yeah, breakfast and I think if I remember right, it was breakfast and lunch for a crew. I think breakfast was usually about 20 or 25 people, and then lunch would be 50 to 60 people.
Cool.
But catering to the same group of people, two meals a day for, I think it was over 2 weeks. That was extremely difficult to just like,
That's challenging.
Always be plumbing, like trying to find something it seems like I'm not serving the same ingredients again and again, but still trying to take in, because it was all offsite. The breakfast was typically a hot drop delivery, and the lunch was wherever they were filming that day. It was insane. I can't imagine doing it for any longer than 2 weeks.
Film set catering, hard job.
Yeah.
Yeah, like keeping the same group of people happy, like with all, you know, like, you know, catering for like 1 or 2 days, you know, people are sort of like willing to forego maybe like their creature comforts or their preferences a little bit, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
After like 3 or 4 days, people are like, ugh, you know, like they really miss the things that they like.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And like, you know, obviously, you know, in some circumstances, like there's a solve for that, mm-hmm. like on like, you know, big budget movie sets, you know, for a lot of people, they bring in a private chef who,
right.
you know,
yeah.
takes care of their meals and understands their preferences and things like that. And that, you know, for something that's not that big a budget, you still have the same set of concerns. Maybe people are going to give you a little bit more leeway, but you know, like, you kind of have to figure out a way to read the room a little bit,
right.
and find out what people want, and maybe make some changes if you need to, or something, if you want people to have like a good experience.
Right.
So,
and I would never say that this is because they were, you know, actors with big egos and unionized film production people with a sense of entitlement. But it happened to be a very difficult group, a very particular group with very particular ideas of what kind of food they should be served.
They should have.
It's a very challenging show.
Yeah, that sounds tricky. Maybe we can do a whole episode about that. I don't know.
I don't want to.
you're still just getting over the PTSD part. It was
a long time ago, but I don't want to talk about it right now.
Fair enough. So what are some things then, what are some lessons that we can take from the idea of, you know, catering being such like a different cooking playing field? What are some like ideas that we can take from that to help ourselves or our listeners have a little bit of an easier time trying to plan like a big family dinner or something like that? What are the little things? You know, obviously there's a lot of complicated things that kind of have to fall into place for everything to be perfect. And especially when you're serving like more than 100 people or something like that, it's, you know, it's a big logistical thing, but not everyone wants to have to consider all of those things when they're just making a turkey dinner. So what are the like helpful tips?
I like one that can kind of be stated as an axiom is like, if it can be done the day before, it should be done the day before.
Should be done.
It, yeah. Even if you think you'll have all the time in the world on service day, like if it can be done in advance, it should be done in advance, plain and simple. There's no earthly reason to make the pie dough the day that you're cooking the pie, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Unless it's for an exam and they require you to make the pie dough on the day.
Yeah. Don't go to your summative assessment on baking pies with a baked pie. That's true. And that's something that's helpful in a professional setting. And in, I know it's hard for home cookings because like if your Thanksgiving dinner is on Sunday, maybe because you work on Thursday and Friday, you can't really take a good chunk out of the prep. But that's my rule is like, there's no reason to do that stuff the day of service. So that means that any of the time on that day can be, you can either reduce your labor budget by having fewer people on hand the day of service in a catering setting, or you can, you know, just have a much more lovely Thanksgiving if you're not running around doing all these tasks that could have been done a day or a week before.
Yeah. It's not fun to be like stressed about when you're going to get the meal on the table, when you're just like hanging out at a family gathering and you want to be socializing with people that you maybe don't get to see all the time or something like that, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important to keep in mind, like, you know, wanting the food to be good is also important. And, you know, being proud of the food that you're preparing is great. I think that like, for me, one of the things that can be super helpful is handing off jobs to people that they want to do, or that they like think that they're, you know, that they think that they can excel at, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, you know, whenever we're planning a family meal, I'm usually doing like a fair portion of like the kind of main dishes or something like that. Mm-hmm. But something like sides or salads or something, you know, like if people have special recipes that they like to bring to those types of meals, like encourage other people to bring other things and kind of make it a potluck. That definitely makes things a lot easier.
Right. It's like outsource or subcontract your catered event. I'm just kidding. Yeah,
where you can,
of course.
Exactly. To help like I mean you know, like it gives other people a little bit of sense of an investment in like the overall experience, which is nice. And then mm-hmm. B, it takes a little bit of something off your plate. Mm-hmm. And another like tip that works well for me, I don't know if this is the same for everyone's family, but another thing that you can kind of do to sort of help dull the kind of anticipation for the meal, or like how exact the timing has to be, is to have snacks are available to people. You know, And in my case, I'm lucky because, you know, like my mom really likes to provide like some snacks for our family dinners, like some charcuterie or some cheese and crackers or something, right. You know, things like that. Yeah. And so she always wants to bring some stuff like that, which is great because it means that if I'm a half an hour late bringing some of the meal to the table or or something like that, nobody's really in a rush. In fact, sometimes it's like trying to gather people and get them to the table when the food is actually ready to go is like a challenge because people are just hanging out, having a good time, and there's, you know, food for them to eat already. I guess the drawback of that is that maybe sometimes in some cases people are full when they sit down to eat the actual meal. Mm-hmm. You know, so depending on your family dynamic, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I feel like in my family we're always willing to eat snacks and then a meal, so right. It doesn't really matter. But yeah, that's a big one. You know, just having something that's just already prepared that like, you know, that like if the timing doesn't quite work out, that people aren't just sitting there starving, just waiting for the meal to hit the table. It takes a little bit of the pressure off.
Getting people's help is actually a big one for the home cooking one, where I have this idea of like the, you know, the proud, well, like you said in, for the Feast of the Seven Fishes or whatever,
fishes
someone
and the bear, yeah.
Has an idea that they're going to be the one to prepare everything and they're going to be kind of the star and the one who everyone thanks afterwards. But yeah, if people want to help, get them to help. It's fun.
Yeah, exactly. Especially people that are interested in learning about cooking. Like if you know something about cooking and there's someone who is interested in getting better at cooking or learning about the way that you do things because they really like the, I don't know, mashed potatoes that you prepare or whatever, you can enlist their help, you know? Yeah, that's a really good one. I had another really good one. What was it? Oh, this isn't so much like a helpful tip as it is just something to remember. It's great to try to plan your meal so that you do as many things ahead of time as possible. That's like, I think rule number one, but like rule number 1B is remember how much oven space you have for preheating things,
right.
Mm-hmm. Or like for reheating things. Mm-hmm. 'Cause that can get a little bit tricky when you have everything pre-prepared, but everything needs to be reheated. Sometimes it's hard to find room in the oven, and also some things really want to be reheated at a different temperature than other things.
Right.
So maybe having like a bit of a backup plan for how you might reheat some things is maybe not a bad idea.
Or just balancing, like we do the same thing in menu design in a regular restaurant where we have to consider the bottlenecks in the equipment that we're using. And so we don't want every single protein to come out of a pan. So it'll be some proteins, maybe our braises and our hot held. Depending on the situation, maybe some are going into the fryer, some are on the grill, some are in pans. I guess the same thing to think of the Thanksgiving meal. Like if you take for granted that the like potatoes could be heated on the stove or in the oven.
Exactly.
But if you're counting on turkey and stuffing and maybe potatoes being in the oven, maybe your vegetable dish should be something that you can do on the stove, like braised cabbage or something like that.
Yeah.
Brussels sprouts in a pan.
Yeah. And if you're having a bit of a potluck, inevitably someone will show up with something that needs to go in the oven when there's no room for it too. And so, you know, it's just like having a little bit of flexibility and having a backup plan, I think, is important. So what were those rules, Alan? Thing one.
Make short ribs. I'm just kidding. That's probably a good ending.
Thing one, do everything ahead that you can do ahead, do it ahead. Thing two, ask for help. Thing three, have snacks around. Thing four, remember there's only so much room in your oven.
Right. We should make a...
Those are the four things.
We'll make a pamphlet.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Follow those rules and... We guarantee you'll have an easier time planning your next family get together.
A pamphlet called Thanksgiving is Fun or Hell. Follow these rules. Yeah.
Don't fall into the trap of the seven fishes.
I picture it more as like a clickbaity article where it's like seven essential rules. Sorry, how many rules was it? Five essential rules.
There was four
essential rules for your next Thanksgiving dinner. You'll never believe what number three is.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. You're good at that, Alan. You should be a social media consultant.
Okay. I'll add it to my business card.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.